Welcome, dear listeners, to this week's segment of Afternoon Satsang, where both of us, Brother Premanush and myself, will continue a beautiful conversation that happened decades back between Hislop and Bhagwan, which have all been documented in the book Conversations with Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba. It's been a long time since we have taken up a general theme, but what we realized is as we go through these conversations, there is such a variety in the themes that have been dealt with. So even if we can be sincere and honest and go through this entire book, it will be very, very enlightening. The journey has been enlightening so far, and I'm sure it will continue to be. So we will continue where we had left off last week. But before we dive into that subject proper, we would like to offer our most humble salutations at the lotus feet of our beloved Bhagwan and wish all of you listeners a very hearty Sai Ram. And let's welcome Brother Prem also. Sai Ram, Prem.
Sai Ram, Arvind, and Sai Ram to all our listeners. And rightly said, variety of themes. Most beautifully, I think what it teaches us is it's giving us an insight into Swami's perspective of things in many ways. We've heard discussions on meditation. We've heard discussions on health and related to regular habits. Last week we were discussing about Swami's a very, very important aspect where Swami spoke about transformation. Swami said that, we might hear stories of people getting transformed overnight. And, I think that's what makes for a good drama script, where in one scene you're able to transform somebody who's having bad ways. In a sense, what happens is I think when you see dramatic representations like that, or even you see movies, or when you read books, you tend to think that that's how transformation is meant to happen. That you come to Swami and then overnight you turn a new leaf. That would be wonderful, and that would be probably the best offering that you can make to Swami. But the truth is, in life it doesn't happen that way. Transformation is a very slow process, and I think the last week, the discussion that we had, it was Swami acknowledging that is how transformation happens, and that's how he lets it happen too. I think that is a very beautiful insight to all of us who are trying to transform. Don't get exasperated with yourself. Don't lose patience with yourself. It is meant to happen slowly, and if you have not transformed, don't give up, first of all, and understand that Swami has not given up on you. I think it's a very, very important thing for all of us who are struggling with ourselves. I don't think any of us can say that I have no more to transform.
And, Swami himself would give the analogy of how when you switch off a fan, it's not as if it comes to a standstill immediately. It takes some time for it to come to a halt. And therefore, patience and perseverance, I think, is part of the spiritual journey. In fact, it's a part of any journey, whether it's secular knowledge and worldly education, whether it's learning a bicycle, learning how to ride a bicycle. With an attempt to teach my daughter how to ride the bicycle, I am realizing how difficult and a patience investing process it actually is. I'm sure all of us have learnt it the hard way only, but because of our memories, we have forgotten about it, And now when you see each aspect of riding a bicycle, just pedaling the bicycle, learning that your legs have to move in synchronicity, controlling the handle, so many things even before you actually come to balancing. So when balancing a bicycle itself requires so much of patience and perseverance, I think achieving balance in life is definitely something that will require a lot of patience and and therefore Swami says that though there are instances like how Ramakrishna Paramahamsa gave a brief experience of that transformation to Swami Vivekananda, Swami again says that it reverted back. It reverted back, and Swami Vivekananda again had to work his way up the spiritual progress. See, that is another aspect. I think it's in the nature of things that, like they say, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. Things that come very fast, they go away also very fast. It is only those things that are slowly built over time that stand the test of time, because we can see it anecdotally, and I don't know, intuitively we can feel it that anything that comes very fast, money, fame, glory, is bound to go off very fast. I remember an interesting talk I think you had only delivered on what happens to people who win the jackpot. compared to those who have invested, learnt lessons and wisely earned money, if you and become a millionaire, compare them with those who have become millionaires by winning a jackpot or a lottery, you see that those who have won the jackpot or lottery don't remain millionaires after becoming one also. So that is the nature of the world, that is the nature of things, that anything that comes very fast, it goes away also very fast. That is why many times when people, you know, would go into that intense emotion rather than devotion in Bhagwan's presence, it would happen. And in that intensity, they would tell many things to Swami, they would promise many things to Swami. And Swami would smilingly point to his hair and say that these many people have seen doing this. And many times I myself would get surprised that here is a person exuding so much of love and devotion. Why is Swami giving him such a cold treatment? Today I feel that Swami knows everything. Swami knows that this intensity is important, but equally important, if not more, is the sustainability of this intensity. So it has to take time, over 10 years, going through ups and downs in lives. If you are able to have the same intensity, Bangarudha, I will welcome you. So, I mean, I don't think any more emphasis is needed to be said about how important patience and perseverance are in the process of transformation and the spiritual path.
In fact, there's a very beautiful discourse. I think it was Swami gave it during one of the Janmashtami celebrations.
Mm-hmm.
Where Swami was talking about these three values, you know, three P's, Swami would call it, patience, purity and perseverance. And a very profound point that Swami makes is, he says, you know, all of you should develop these three qualities because these are divine qualities. These are Swami's qualities, Swami says.
Hmm.
And he says that I am what I am because I have purity, patience and perseverance. So if you want to become me, you have to develop these three qualities.
Wow.
So, you know, that's how much value Swami gives to that. And as you said, I mean, we all have gone through that. You know, the first semester in the hostel, you would have a hostel of saints, right? Everybody is so charged. Everybody is so focused on Swami. But yes, with time, that emotion wears out, right? It's a very powerful experience to come in contact with Swami. And that reflects in the way you behave initially. But, you know, as they say, the real worth is when things fade out and when situations change and how you stand up to that.
It reminds me, you know, when you go to many of the South Indian coffee or tea houses, mm-hmm. they have this unique way of cooling coffee and tea where they pour it from one glass to the other from a great height.
Right.
And, you know, so in any hotel or roadside cafe, anywhere you go, they give you a small glass with coffee that's a glass which is 130% full, you know. Because it looks like, oh God, and that's why they give you a saucer which is almost a bowl. You know, it's not just a saucer, it's a bowl, because you feel how on earth are they fitting 140% of tea in a in a glass. But even as you go and start cooling it all wears down, you see the glass is only about 80% filled. Almost 50% of it is the froth that is generated. I feel that's what happens when we come to Swami also for the first time, or Prashanthi and Liam. There is that basis of undercurrent of devotion, but there's a huge amount of froth of emotion above it, you know. And at first it looks like, oh my God, there's no difference between a saint who is overflowing with divine bliss and this person who is having so much froth above. But once the froth clears, you get to see where the devotion is. And yes.
Interestingly, you know, even as you mentioned this thing of how they cool coffee or milk,
mm-hmm.
I'm reminded of another incident which is not related to the analogy that you gave, but related to what we are speaking about in general. I'm sure we must have mentioned this before. Once, apparently when Swami, in the early years when Professor Kasturi had come to Swami one day, suddenly there was a discussion in the interview room, and Swami said, which is the best way to cool milk?
Right?
Is it to pour from one tumbler or one vessel to the other, or put it in a trough of cold water? And they said, where is this coming from? And, you know, is there any spiritual message? Nothing. Swami just discussed about it. And Swami didn't give an answer. And Swami looked at Professor Kasturi, and Swami tells him that ask your mother, and then with chuckle Swami adds, tell her that the way she is doing it is wrong.
Okay.
Okay. Then he goes back and I think he asks his mother, you know, this is what Swami said. The mother is very surprised because she had the habit of doing prayers to Swami in the altar every day by offering a glass of milk.
Hmm.
And the milk would have just come out of, you know, the boiling vessel. So she had to cool it and then offer it to Swami. And some days she would find that, you know, it's getting late for her prayer. So she would cool it by putting it in a trough of water. Right?
Okay.
The whole tumbler would be immersed in a trough of cold water. And it would cool down quickly, right? And then she would place it. And Swami was telling her that that way is the wrong way to do it. So if you really look at it, that is the faster way or the instant way of cooling down. Mm-hmm. This is a more, you know, painstaking effort oriented way. And I think even there, Swami is saying, take the path which is seems to be more tougher and, you know, more cumbersome, because always...
Not tougher, right. But tougher.
Right. Slow and steady is always the better way.
Moving ahead with the conversation where we stopped, Hislop asks Swami, how should one listen to Swami when he is in conversation or giving a discourse? That is, Swami's words have so many deep and deeper levels. And Swami replies, Swami is speaking to you in a body with a voice. Listen in the natural way. At length, body and mind drop away and there is divine direct understanding. So Swami's answer is very simple. Need not do any extra preparation or any extra effort in listening to Swami. The way you focus and listen to anybody or anything else, just focus and listen in that way, in that manner. It's almost like, you know, Swami saying that his words and his message are like seeds that are being planted in the fields of our heart. What do you do to plant a seed? You just plant the seed, let it be there. Whenever the time is ripe, in the sense whenever there's a fall of rain, whenever there's rainfall, whenever the temperature is favorable, the seeds will sprout themselves. So, again, this is a very nice message because it shows that when we are, you know, driving to work and listening to Swami's discourse, or when we are taking a walk in the evening and listening to Swami's discourse, or early in the morning we put on Swami's discourse so that as we are doing whatever, the morning chores, we can listen to it. All of this is fine. It's okay. It is just like listening to another conversation. I'm saying this is very nice because if we think that we have to set aside 1 hour a day where we do nothing else, just sit and focus because this is Swami's discourse, Swami himself is saying it's not needed because it will seep in, it will go in. And this has been my personal experience, and I'm sure it is the experience for many others as well, where though you're unconsciously listening to a discourse, some part of the discourse, some sections seem to stand out and impact you so much. It's almost like the answer that you have been looking for. So it shows that all we need to do is just be available to Swami, just be available, and not bother too much about anything else because Swami will take care of the rest.
Right, because, you know, as they say, listening itself is a kind of a sadhana, and because there's so many things. They say you should be thoughtless, you have to be without thinking. And I think that's where it comes from, because a lot of mindfulness and Zen philosophy talks about listening as a very intense process. And Swami zeroes it down to saying that just listen like how you would listen to everybody else. But I think what Swami is saying in the end is very profound. He's saying then there will be divine direct understanding. Right? Mm. Because according to Vedanta, as Swami has said many times before, we always look at learning and understanding only through the mind. And there is an understanding which is beyond the mind. Right? And that process to reach that understanding is through the mind. It's a classic example, you know, we must have narrated that analogy sometime before, where a man falls into a deep crevice and he's hanging from a root and it's pitch dark, he's calling out for help. It's a very famous story which is often said, and then he hears the voice of God who says, don't worry, you let go and I will save you. Mm. Right? And the man says, is there anybody else? Because he doesn't want to let go. Right? And then the next day they find that he's actually hanging just a few feet away from the ground. And whenever this analogy is narrated, they say that, see, there are two ways in which he was going to learn to have faith. One is by listening to that voice. Right? The voice was telling him, have faith. The other is, if he had let go, he need not be told that to have faith. That faith would have been a spontaneous experience for him. Hmm. Right? Next time in a situation, he'll know that God is there. Right? But to experience that understanding, as Swami is saying, divine direct understanding, you go through it through that listening process. Through the mind, you actually get that experience which is beyond the mind. Right? And it's a very, if you look at it, they say, then there's a very beautiful experience which Dr. Gokak, I think, narrates. Dr. Gokak or Bhagwandam, I don't know which one of them. Mm-hmm. Where during one of Swami's Samukos discourses, Swami extensively quotes from Western philosophers. right? He says Socrates says this, and so and so disagrees with this. Kent says this, and all Nietzsche's philosophy and all that, and everybody was flabbergasted, you know, because they never heard Swami speak of such topics.
Mm.
It's okay if Swami speaks about Bhagavad Gita and all that. You're not so surprised because you know it's all right. Even you know, traditional families have that learning which is part of the family, but here is Swami really quoting from. Unless you've done a MA philosophy course or something, you won't probably be aware of all these names. So apparently at the end of it, this elderly gentleman goes and asks Swami, Swami, how did you know all these things? Where did you read all these things? And then Swami very, you know, jocularly says, I do not have the bad habit of reading books. Right? And then Swami tells him that, see, it is not only my divine ability. Swami said, every human brain has this ability.
Mm.
He says, you have the opportunity to access infinite knowledge. But right now, your mind is filled with body consciousness. So whatever learning you do through this body, you think only that knowledge you have. But when you let go of that body consciousness, you become like a channel through which the universal
knowledge can flow.
Right?
And though we might not have experienced it like Swami, I'm sure we have all had these moments of intuition. Where suddenly you get a brilliant answer or a brilliant solution for a problem that you are grappling with, and you wonder, hey, how did I not think of this? Hey, how elegant this is. And more often than not, this happens in situations when you are caught totally unaware. You know, there are also a couple of, you know, serials, detective based serials, wherein, you know, the detective or even a medical serial where the diagnosing doctor gets their brilliant flash in absolutely unrelated moments. You know, you're working on a case, you're feverishly thinking about it, or you're working on a medical case, you're feverishly thinking about it, you don't know, you're at a wit's end, and then you go to the coffee house and you're having coffee and somebody remarks something about his garden somewhere, and suddenly the flower there strikes something in you and you get the answer.
Mm.
I mean, believe it or not, if I had come and told you the same flower thing, whatever you heard in the cafe, when you were feverishly thinking about the problem, you would not have come up with the solution. That's because when you are feverishly thinking about something, your mind is involved in that. And when the mind is caught unawares, I think this is an opportunity for that, the true self within, which is beyond the mind, to access this. And that is the reason I think Swami could access it every time, because every time he was in the state that's beyond the mind. We mortals are able to access it now and then when we are able to, you know, transcend the mind involuntarily. It's because the mind is so preoccupied in something else that it doesn't notice this. Notice this that is so evident, you know. And for that also we have had experiences of people searching for their spectacles though it's on their head. You know, that shows when the mind is preoccupied, it can miss obvious things. And that is why this becomes a positive way for the higher self to actually come in with the solution when the mind is preoccupied with something else. I remember a Laurel and Hardy conversation where Laurel is reading out a tragic letter to Hardy, to Oliver Hardy. And when he reads out all that, by the end of the letter, Oliver Hardy is, you know, crying. He's crying and Laurel asks, hey, what happened? He says, what happened? Didn't you read it? He said, yeah, but I wasn't listening, you know. We all laughed at it, but that is a real life thing that happens many times. So, I think Swami is saying here is, don't be like that, possibly like that, Laurel. Yeah, be available. Listen. Listen because this, you know, when we say intuition is the higher self speaking when the mind is preoccupied, when the mind is, you know, not rushing in with its own interpretations. Swami is also like the voice of that higher self only. And when we listen to Swami, we get that rare opportunity. See, another way of seeing it is, suppose Swami were to tell me something directly versus Swami tells you something in the interview room and you come and tell me outside. There's definitely going to be a world of difference in the two. Now, I can just replace you with the mind. So when the mind is there like that, you know, mindfully focusing, trying to make extra effort and listen, it will possibly become an interpreter at a subtle level. So that's why possibly Swami is saying that, what is that statement that Swami makes? He says, there's a direct I'm sorry, I just lost that.
Divine direct understanding.
Yes, there will be a divine direct understanding. I feel without any of the biases that are present in the mind, you get an understanding that's very, very unique. You get that. And that's why just normally in a relaxed manner, without putting in any undue or extra effort, listen to Bhagavan.
And I think it's also what it's, you know, very famously referred to as, and you know, Swami has also extensively spoken about it.
Mm-hmm.
The processes of Shravanam, Mananam, and Adhidhyasanam. Right? If you look at it, Swami says, you know, when you're born, you're completely like a clean slate.
Mm.
You're asking, who am I? You know, the crying of a child, which is, it sounds like koham, koham.
Mm.
Who am I? Who am I?
Mm.
So Swami says that you're given a flood of information at that moment. Somebody comes and says, I'm your mother. Somebody comes and says, I'm your father.
Hmm.
Suddenly a name is given and said, this is your name. Right? And Swami would say that the child which is born looks at its body as an external object. Right? It doesn't realize that the body is the child. Right? And all the experiences and reinforcements from outside make you believe that you're this person, you're so-and-so's son, you're this body, and if something happens to the body, you're supposed to, you know, feel bad. And all of that is external information which has now become your perception.
Mm.
So when Swami says, when you listen to me, listen like you listen to everybody else, I think that what Swami is saying is, what is, when you listen to Swami, it is again information. Right? What is Swami saying? Swami is saying, you're not this body, you're divine. All of that is information. But at one point, as Swami is saying, it'll become direct understanding. I think that becomes insight.
Mm.
Even as information, it is worthwhile, right? Even as we go through life, I don't realize that I'm divine, I'm not this body, and I'm all my suffering is only imagination. I don't realize that as an insight. But even as information, it is very useful for me to make my decisions in a very informed manner. But Swami says, even as you give importance to this and keep listening to it, keep factoring it into your life, at one moment, it will be a direct understanding. It is not through the mind, it is not through the senses, but you will know it. You will know it is there. This is the truth.
A related point is something very interesting that Brother Sai Prakash told me yesterday. You know, it is not as if when you say Shravanam, Mananam, Nididhyasanam, it is not as if once you reach Nididhyasanam, you can give up Shravanam. It's not as if once you have got insight, you can give up listening. It is not without reason that Shravanam has been elevated to a form of devotion in the Navvida Bhakti Marga. In fact, what Brother Sai Prakash told me is that he came across a discourse in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the exact discourse. Wherein Swami is saying, why was Sita so sad before Hanuman actually met her? Why is it that Sita became so happy after Hanuman met her? And Swami said, the difference is only in one thing. Whether Hanuman was there or not, Sita was always lost only in thoughts of Rama. Yet she was not happy because before Hanuman came, she had only Mananam and Nididhyasanam. It is only when Hanuman came and sang the glories of Rama, she could get Shravanam also along with Mananam and Nididhyasanam. Then alone she could experience joy. So Swami says that it is not as if once you have had Shravanam and you are in Mananam and Nididhyasanam, you should give up Shravanam. Shravanam should continue unabated. When all these three are there together always only, you get joy.
Beautiful. I think that's a very, very profound insight from Swami, I think, right? So that's the first question. And as we said, it really stands out as a question compared to what we were discussing the last time.
Mm.
But nevertheless, it's a very important point. And also another question that shows that it's coming from a very informed spiritual aspirant. It is not random questions. Many times you would see in these question answer sessions, which are recorded, I think, in Kodaikanal, there are some few occasions, or Thrai Brindavan. We as students would ask a lot of things, you know, just to appear, not appear intelligent, but most often it will be like,
to engage Swami.
Swami,
yes,
right? That would be the main focus. You know, if you don't ask questions, I still recall when Swami would call boys for interview, they would say that just ask something randomly, because if there's too much silence, you're scared. Swami will say, okay.
Session over, get session, up and,
get up and go.
Swami, how to control mind, Swami? Simply.
Right, simply. And, but, you know, and Swami would answer it, but at the end of it, Swami will say, you know, urke adukko, you know, don't simply ask, you know, without having that real desire to know that answer, you should not ask. I think that's why Swami is in detail answering some of these questions. And that's also another reason why we are not able to so many times relate to the answers completely, because
correct,
the mananam which is required before the questioning has not happened. I think we'll just take a quick break, because again, the next question which comes is also a pretty different from what question Hislop has asked just now. So we'll take a short break, dear listeners. Don't go away. We'll resume this very interesting conversation after this break.
ಕಲಿಮಲ ಭಂಜನ ಕೋದಂಡರಾಮ
ಕಲಿಮಲ ಭಂಜನ ಕೋದಂಡರಾಮ
ಕಲಿಮಲ ಭಂಜನ ಕೋದಂಡರಾಮ
ಕಲಿಮಲ ಭಂಜನ ಕೋದಂಡರಾಮ
ಕರುಣಾಂತರಂಗ ಕೈವಲ್ಯಧಾಮ ಕರುಣಾಂತರಂಗ ಕೈವಲ್ಯಧಾಮ ಕಲಿಮಲ ಭಂಜನ ಕೋದಂಡರಾಮ
Welcome back, dear listeners. Going back to the conversation which is happening, Hislop asks the next question after this question on listening. He says, Swami is often heard saying, yes, yes, yes. And Swami's response to that is, yes, yes, yes. It refers to inner acceptance. Experiences and situations arise in the life of a person. His tendency is to say yes to that which is pleasing and no if the prospect is otherwise. This is a great mistake. Swami says yes, yes, yes to everything that comes to him. Mm. All is the gift of God. Every experience given by God is good. Through sincere and loving inquiry, that good will be found in every experience. Yes, yes, yes refers to inner acceptance. But there is bad work and good work. Whatever they are real. Yes, yes, yes does not change them. A man locks his valuables in a safe and carries away the key in the belief that it is safe. But thieves take the safe and break it open. So one must be sure that he understands the essentials of every situation. So that is the answer that Swami gives, and I think it's based on a very popular padyam that Swami would say. I don't know the exact words where Swami says, yes anivariki, yes anura, no one anivari, no anura, something that.
Yes, no, lu, no, tiki kani, sai ki sarvam, yes, yes, yes,
yes. Meaning that to those who say yes, I say yes, to those who say no, I say no, and.
Means it is like, you know, Swami says yes for everything. So if you are saying yes, it is yes from my side.
Right.
If you are saying no, I tell yes for that also. So it is no to you then.
Right.
Because it's like a positive, positive make a positive, negative make a negative.
Right.
So Swami is saying the yes and no is only for the tongue, but for Sai, it's always S, S, S.
Right.
It's also poetic because Shri Satya Sai is S, S, S.
Right. And here it's a very beautiful explanation of what Swami means by that. Where you say that you, it's a sign of acceptance of whatever comes to you. It's not about accepting the positive things in life and then saying no and denying the negative things in life.
You know, I think, you know, when people would go and tell Swami, it's my birthday, Swami would tell Manchidi. Go and same thing when you speak over somebody who is sick or ill, Swami says Manchidi. You know, and this happened not just with others, you know, when in the worldly sense, you talk of people who mattered to Swami. Even when it came to them, Swami was absolutely nonchalant and, you know, absolutely detached, yet involved. You know, he would do everything that is necessary, but he would not go on an emotional roller coaster either ways, in happiness or in sorrow. So Swami says that when I say Sai, for Swami everything is yes, yes, yes. It speaks of inner acceptance. And Swami says that is what... it is almost like Swami saying, that's what I expect in your lives also, if you say that you are with Swami. If you are a Sai devotee, if you are a student, Sai student, then this inner acceptance should become part of your life. You should not say no for anything. You know, that's why in that poem, Swami would say that those who tell yes to me, I tell yes to them. Those who tell no to me, I tell yes to them also. So, because you said yes, you got back yes. Because you said no and I agreed to that, you get back no. So it is based on what you are saying. For me, it is every time it's only yes and yes and yes. There's an absolute acceptance. In fact, this acceptance is the hallmark of a devotee, Swami would say. That is what is also called surrender. And in many, many ways, with many analogies, Swami has explained this. One that comes to my mind is what he would tell on Ugadi Day. Ugadi is the new year for the states of Karnataka and Andhra Pradesh, the Telugu and Kannada New Years. And one of the traditions is to have an Ugadi Pachadi, which is a kind of a pasty liquid that is made with all the five tastes, spicy, sour, salty, sweet, astringent, all the five tastes will be put in it. And it's not, normally it's not a very pleasant thing to eat. But the tradition is you have to partake it on Ugadi, and there's an added condition that you should not wince or, you know, make a face while eating it. You have to eat it with a pleasant face. So till I came to Swami, you know, it was just a tradition that I followed. But it's only after coming to Swami during the first ever Ugadi itself as a student, Swami so clearly mentioned that the significance of that is whatever is coming to me in this year, I shall accept it as Lord's Prasadam. And Lord's Prasadam, you know, when I go to a temple and they're giving Prasadam, I won't ask, is there ghee in the Prasadam? Is it spicy Prasadam or is it salty or is it sweet? I don't care. It's not here for tasting. It is God's Prasadam and I accept it with reverence and love and partake it with devotion. The same way all the circumstances and instances that come to us in our life, we have to partake it with that same love and devotion because it is Swami's Prasadam. That is the explanation that I got on the first Ugadi as a student here. It was so beautiful, so thrilling. And that is what Swami is saying here, that it is not as if I am telling you to follow this. This is what Sai also does. Because for Sai, everything is yes, yes, yes. There is an inner acceptance. You know, whether people, you know, in his childhood, we have seen that, whether they called him guru and made him sit on top of a, palanquin during a procession, or whether they shaved his head and made cross marks and squeezed lemon juice and chili turmeric onto the head. For both, Swami was equanimous. He neither got, only his physical body went up and down. He never went up or went down. He was never demoralized. He was never elated or, you know, on top of, in seventh heaven or anything like that. So his life has definitely been an amplification of what he has preached, what he has taught as his message. And that's why I think very clearly Swami is saying here that I am in a state of absolute inner acceptance all the while. Therefore, Sai Ki Sarvam, yes, yes, yes.
But the later part of that answer which Swami gives again is conditioning whatever Swami is saying here, because, you know, whenever you talk about there's nothing right and wrong, everything should be accepted, you know, you go with the flow, you always confuse that with a life where you don't discriminate, right? It's not necessary to discriminate between right and wrong, good and bad. That's why immediately Swami qualifies it. He's saying that does not make what is bad work right. Bad is bad, good is good. Right? You have to do what you have to do. As you know, I think Swami is giving him a version of the famous American quotation where they say, have faith in God but lock your car. That's supposed to be a very famous American expression. So Swami is saying it, you know, you will have to lock your safe. The people might, it might still have dangers and somebody might still rob it, but what you have to do, you're supposed to do. So I think when Swami says yes, 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 it is a clear thing that, you know, you do what you're supposed to do and accept whatever comes, right? That is the idea of, it is not like, you know, somebody comes and offers you, asks you to do something which is wrong. Don't say yes to that and do it and say that Swami has told yes, yes, yes to everything. That is not the kind of yes man that Swami is talking about. And Swami would say that, you know, a beautiful analogy which Swami...
Just to highlight what you said, that's why I think Swami says it's inner acceptance, not outer acceptance.
Right.
It's not as if you tell yes to that fellow who is... Inwardly you accept.
Yeah. I mean, there's a very beautiful analogy that Swami gives, you know, the difference between man and an animal, Swami says.
Mm-hmm.
He says, you know, if you take a goat to a person who is holding a stick in one hand and he's holding a bunch of leaves in one hand, and if he shows the stick, the animal will take a few steps back. If you show the leaves, it'll go forward, right? Swami says it's clear. It's all works, all its actions dependent on what it thinks is pleasant and what it thinks is unpleasant.
Mm.
So if you also live a life like that, then you're leading an animal life. So Swami goes on to say that your preference of one over the other should be beyond your likes and dislikes, your idea of what is pleasant and unpleasant. And then Swami says that is where, you know, the idea of buddhi and morality and what you think is the ultimate takes you on the right path, and all of that comes into play. So that discrimination is there when Swami says that there is no right and wrong, or you say yes and yes to everything. It means you do not, you know, pleasant and unpleasant should not dictate your actions. To that you should be yes, but when you act, right and wrong discrimination should always be there.
Another thought that struck me, possibly based on my life experience, is that when Swami says, you lock your valuables in a safe and carry away the key in the belief that it is safe, but thieves take the safe itself and break it open. So you must be sure that you understand the essentials of the situation. I also feel one interpretation of this would be that when you surrender in this manner, when you accept everything as good for you, now don't assume that because of this kind of acceptance, things will turn back to how you desire. You know, I'm saying this because there have been instances where people have come and asked me that, you know, Swami says if you surrender, everything will be fine. I have surrendered, yet I'm not having a job. Or I have surrendered, yet my mother is not getting cured. I have surrendered, yet my daughter is not getting married. In the prayer of surrender, Swami beautifully says that to worry about something after you have surrendered shows that you have not surrendered. You know, the definition of surrender itself is whatever happens is good for me. It is fine. I accept it. You know, if you have accepted it, then what are you complaining about? So I think that aspect is being made clear as to, you know, when you surrender, it does not imply that from that moment, everything will start happening as per your desires. That was one interpretation I got based on yeah. Why Swami is saying that.
I think another way probably of looking that at it is, you know, you have to do what your duty is, in the sense like when Swami says you might lock it, but the safe itself might be carried away. Probably Swami is talking of something very practical that, you know, don't say that I have done a little bit and that's all it is. You have to look at all the contingencies and then plan for it. You know, that is a duty that's different from you saying that I've surrendered completely to Swami. So correct. It's like, yeah, if the safe itself is...
Having right, done everything, you have right. locked the safe, you have locked the house, you have installed the alarm, you have notified, you have done everything. In spite of that, something happens, yeah, that's beyond. But you cannot say that I'll leave my lock, everything and I'll... correct, that's right. At this point of time, dear listeners, we'll take a quick break, another quick little break, and come back to the next part of the conversation. Again, there is a change in theme and topic, and again it gets always.
Krishna Madhava, Madhava Krishna. Krishna Madhava, Madhava Krishna.
Krishna Madhava, Madhava Krishna.
Krishna Madhava, Sai Hare. Krishna Madhava, Sai Hare.
Krishna Madhava, Sai Hare.
Vrindavan Sanchari, Shama Gopala. Krishna Madhava, Madhava Krishna.
Krishna Madhava, Madhava Krishna.
Krishna Madhava, Sai Hare. Jaya Madhusudana, Jaya Nandalala. झूले मेरे साई नंदलाला झूलन झूले मेरे साई नंदलाला कृष्ण माधवा माधव कृष्णा
Welcome back, dear listeners. And the next thing that Hislop says is, I think, something all of us would say had we gone through this conversation with Swami, because Hislop says, all the subtle inside and outside tasks to be done, spiritual life seems very difficult. And Swami responds to that. He says, vital to spiritual life is self-confidence, the conviction that one is the Atma. Spiritual life is easy. There are some initial problems, as in learning anything. But it is easy. A bowl turned upside down remains dry no matter how heavy the rain. Whereas a bowl turned up collects some rain even though the rain is very light. If the heart is turned towards God, some grace will be received. If the interest and devotion is intense, grace will fill the bowl. So, Swami, the eternal advertiser and marketer for spirituality through the ages, says that no, spirituality is very easy. It's only having teething troubles. It has only initial problems and setbacks. And when Swami says it, definitely that is the truth. It just shows how lousy or non-persevering we are, that with the initial setbacks itself, we give up on this. And Swami is saying that only that if you are able to tide across the initial setbacks, you will see that it's so easy, and it's definitely easier than worldly problems and, you know, non-spiritual life. But the problem is that at the initial setbacks itself, we seem to give up. The only way that you can hold on and not give up in spite of initial setbacks is to have self-confidence. No wonder that even in discourses, Swami would stress that the mansion of self-realization is built on the foundation of self-confidence. Then Swami would say, I think the walls of self-satisfaction and the roof of self-sacrifice, or is it the other way? I don't know. The walls of self-sacrifice and roof of self-satisfaction. One of these, he says, you have to have this, but all of this is built on the foundation of self-confidence. That is very vital. You have to proceed with self-confidence. And self-confidence is nothing but, I think, confidence or having faith in the God within each and every one of us. So Swami says, once that is there, then you will tide through. We spoke about bicycle riding, about how hard it is, how difficult it is. Each aspect is so difficult. You have to learn them aspect by aspect. But you know what, Prem? Once you have learnt, you know, I was speaking to my sister, and when we had gone on a holiday, they were renting out bicycles to ride on the beach. Mm-hmm. And my sister has not ridden a bicycle since, I don't know, maybe 15 years, 1.5 decades. She took it after a little bit of hesitation. You know, it was a hesitation to ride, but actually when she mounted the bicycle and began to ride it, she did it as well as she was doing it possibly 15 years ago. I think that's very, very symbolic for the spiritual journey as well, that initially you will fall, you will have scrapes, you will have bruises. Each aspect will feel so difficult. Even as you focus on one aspect, the other aspect will go awry. As you're trying to control the handle, your pedaling will stop. When you're getting the control, handle control and pedaling together, your balance is gone. All these are initial setbacks. But once you master it, after that, you know, even if you're out of touch in the sense for so many years, you never lose it. It is something that you have earned forever. And the beautiful thing is, when it comes to spiritual progress, unlike bicycling, this learning lasts forever in the sense that it lasts even across births. So I think that should be the greatest motivating speech for all of us, where Swami says, no, it is very easy. Just persevere, hold on, and cross these initial difficulties with self-confidence. Once you do that, it's going to be as easy as riding a bicycle.
Swami says in one of the discourses, I think he speaks about the sages of the Yore and how they lived for hundreds of years and they practiced sadhana and all of that. And then Swami says, see, this is like the greatest achievement of your life.
Hmm.
I always say, you know, when you're students, when we are studying in school, you will know how good you are at academics and you will accordingly choose, you know, your future.
Hmm.
If you're an average student, you will not think about IITs and IAs and all of that. You'll say, you know, that's not my cup of tea. I'll go with something which is a little lighter. Probably I'll try for a good engineering degree or something like that. But if you're really competitive, you'll go for the highest thing. Which means even in our mind, we know that there are some things which call for very rigorous, effort.
Mm.
So Swami says you're talking about the ultimate spiritual goal, right? That's going to be tougher than everything else you have tried. It's not going to be easy at all. So one is that acknowledgement that what you're trying is difficult. But in that discourse, Swami says, but you should never think that, oh, this is so difficult, so I will never try.
Mm.
Swami says, when you look at all of these sages and great people, you should feel that in what way are they different from me? They're also humans like me. They were also born like me. They also lived like me. So I can achieve what they achieved. Swami said that you should have that self-confidence. You should have the acknowledgement that it's not an easy path. But along with that, you should have the self-confidence that I can reach it. And Swami is saying that that self-confidence is very, very important. But if you really look at it, you know, when you look at any achievement, let's say anything which is worldly, I want to become rich, I want to be very learned. At some point, where you stop is actually when you find satisfaction, not beyond that. Because there'll be always somebody who is better than you, somebody who is richer than you, somebody who is more good-looking than you, somebody who is more learned than you. At some point, you have to say that this is enough for me. So which means even in the worldly level, it all comes when you're satisfied or when you realize that this hunger can never be satiated by this kind of gathering. So when you're talking about spirituality, it is about that's self-satisfaction that Swami is talking about. So, you know, it is the easiest in that sense that you don't have to do this roundabout and then come to this understanding. You're starting off with this idea that how do I get that self-satisfaction? That's why Swami would say that it is easy. As Swami would often say, you know, he'll take his handkerchief and say, is it difficult to hold the handkerchief or is it difficult to let go of the handkerchief? So Swami would say, detachment is easy. Letting go is easy. Not being worried is easy.
Mm.
So spirituality is easy. But because you're thinking of, you know, I will satisfy all of this and then I will, you know, I'll feel that fulfillment. So it is looking like it's going to be a very difficult task. Actually, it's much easier than, you know, grabbing all this knowledge or trying to become rich or trying to become, very famous and all of that.
See, when you speak of letting go and contentment, I'm reminded of a passing statement that Lakshmi Narayan sir, of I think Sadhana Trust trustee he is, mm-hmm. He had come to office day before yesterday and while sitting, he just made a comment. I found it so beautiful. He said, we gather stuff so that we can get knowledge. We give up stuff so that we can get wisdom. He said, and I found it so true. That is how it is when we realize that to be rich means to be content and not about possessing everything. You know, in fact, I was just researching a little bit on ceiling on desires because that is going to be the theme for my Friday hosted videos. So when I was researching that, I found something very interesting that connects ceiling on desires with even self-confidence. You know, Swami, even there, is giving so much importance to self-confidence. And, you know, ceiling on desires is basically about not wasting food, not wasting time, not wasting energy and time, food, energy, money.
Money.
These are the four things Swami says you should not waste or misuse. And when it comes to misusing time, Swami speaks about wasteful talking and meaningless talking, which leads to waste of time and even later time waste of energy. There Swami says, particularly you have to be very careful that what you speak does not damage the faith of another person mm-hmm. or the self-confidence of the other person. Mm-hmm. Swami says that is the worst sin that you can do. You know, damaging the faith and self-confidence of another person is the worst sin that you can do. Refrain from doing that. I found it very significant because it shows how important self-confidence is. And as we have discussed many times before in the same forum, that self-confidence and faith are two sides of the same coin. When you have confidence in the God who is outside of you, you call it faith. When you have faith in the Lord who is within you, you call it self-confidence. So they are basically two sides of the same coin only. And that is why Swami says there that if you speak, you refrain from speaking, you know, while talking about not misusing time and energy, Swami says, don't speak anything that destroys the faith or self-confidence of anybody. That is the worst possible sin.
Right. And I think that's the clear answer that Swami gives. And then he continues in that same answer. Mm. Swami says, it is life in the outer world that is endless trouble, whereas spiritual life is easy. One already has the necessary concentration. To be reborn again and again requires no work. Not to be reborn again requires much work. Mm. To gain wealth requires much work. To remain poor requires no work. So I think the whole idea, if you look at it, at least from these two, three statements that Swami is making, it's all about making that choice, right? We find it difficult because making the choice seems to be difficult.
Correct.
The post the choice thing, actually speaking, spiritual life is easier. Letting go is easier, to be satisfied is easier, to not run after things is easier. But to make the choice, it seems to be easier to choose the world than choosing spirituality. But once the choice is made, this is easier than that.
That's what is Shreyas and Prayas, right?
Right.
Prayas is the spiritual one and right. Shreyas is the worldly.
The Shreyas is the spiritual one.
Oh, okay. Right. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. So, I was just reminded of Brother Amay. Mm-hmm. He was telling that when Swami used to visit higher secondary school to see the exhibitions that the boys would make, so a lot of preparation would go into making models or making displays which would, in quotes, impress Swami. So what Brother Amay had made was a model in which, there are two paths going on. There are two paths that are branching out from the from one point. And at that point, he had put Swami's picture. And on one path, he had put thorns in the beginning and flower petals later on. And in the other path, he had put flower petals in the beginning and thorns later on. And he said that Swami showed a lot of keen interest in that model, asked for all explanation. In fact, he said just to make the model look complete, he had filled up lawns, some grass all around. Okay. So when Swami came, Swami was very keen. Swami started speaking. They had strictly been told that no more than 10 to 15 seconds per model because Swami should see everybody's. But Swami himself started asking, okay, what is this? What is that? So then he explained to Swami, saying, Swami, this is Shreyas and Prayas. Prayas is the worldly path. In the beginning, it appears like rose petals, but later on, it's a full path filled with thorns. Whereas Shreyas, the spiritual path, in the beginning, it appears to be filled with thorns, but it is full of rose petals later on. And Swami then asked, what is Swami's picture doing there? He said, Swami, you are the Sakshi Bhutam. You are the eternal witness of those who take either path. And then he says that Swami then touched the lawns on the side of the grass and said, what is this? He said, I had no meaning for that. It was just put there to fill up the space. Mm-hmm. But the point is, this is possibly the reason why we are hesitant to make the choice for a spiritual life. Because on the face of it, it looks very difficult. So many times we have heard, our own relatives, friends, well-wishers who are not much familiar with Swami actually getting scared. Oh, you're going to some Swami. You're going to go and join a school over there. What will happen? No career. You're not going to get married. Who you're going to give up? You'll not get enough salary. These are things that crop up the moment you tell you're going to an ashram or Swami. And all this looks very difficult from a worldly point of view. These are all like the thorns in the beginning. It is only those, I think, who have had a glimpse of the rose petal laid path ahead will be able to, take this decision and move. And I feel that is where all of us have been lucky. We have been given a glimpse of what it is to lead a life with Swami. So therefore, I think we should make our lives into examples wherein everybody can see that if you are able to withstand the early thorny part, it's going to be beautiful. And over here, it might be looking attractive with all rose petals in the beginning. But the moment you enter, it becomes too late to turn back because it's all thorns after that.
Right. So that is Swami's explanation. He says the spiritual path is easier. And, there's a marketing principle, they say, I don't know whether it's really there in any book or somebody was making a lighthearted reference to it. He said, give your toughest problem to your laziest employee. You'll find the easiest solution. Right? So if you're really lazy by nature, I think you should be choosing the spiritual path in that sense. Not lazy in that sense, but if you really are desperate to reach earlier, or you're desperate for, as Swami would, you know, the very term Shreyas itself means, Shreya means it's the better one. Right?
Mm.
Prayas is something which is beneficial or pleasant, but Shreyas is also another name for the ultimate goal. Right? That's why it is said that if you're interested in reaching the ultimate goal, this is the easiest path. And that path also will eventually, you'll get beaten up by the world and then you'll turn to this path. But if your goal is fixed and you want to reach there fast, if you're desperate, if you're lazy, and if you're keen on reaching there earlier, then you should take the spiritual path.
Just a passing thought. I have come across quite a few Shreyas in my life. I don't think I have come across any Prayas. Have you? I mean, by name Prayas.
Recently, I saw somebody who was named Prayas. I thought definitely their parents don't know what they would have just liked the sound of it, and they named their child.
Oh, maybe.
Right.
Yeah, but commonly in India we find Shreyas. I think that should be easy way to ensure that. No, I'm not talking anything higher. I'm just talking about a way to ensure that I don't get confused what is what.
Right.
Now, I thought Prayas is the higher work, higher path, and Shreyas is the lower one. But let me remember that the more common name is a greater aspiration.
Right. Swami would use it in another context. You say, na Shreyo Niyamam Vina, Swami would say. There is no betterment in life without having discipline. Right. So, Shreyas literally means to raise a higher in that sense.
Possibly we can take on one final question, Prem, because it's 1:45, we have about 10-12 minutes. And it's again another theme here. Hislop says, when a person is in the waking state, he can observe that the dream experience is a projection of his own mind. Swami says that the waking state is also a dream. But where is the vantage point from which we may observe that the waking state is also only a dream? I think this question comes from somebody who is really, really very deep. And Swami says, one may have a dream that he is a child, that he attends school, makes friends, marries, is a father, and has a career. A sequence of events that covers 45 years of his life. The dream may occur at 3:15 a.m. and be over by 3:17 a.m. In 2 minutes of waking time, the dreamer has experienced events that extend through 45 years of dream time. When the waking state is transcended, it also is seen to be a dream. And a lifetime in the waking state has taken only a few moments in the transcendental state. The waking state is seen to be the dream, and the dream state is seen as a dream within a dream. So when Hislop asks, Swami, when I wake up, I know in a dream state, the dream experience is a projection of the mind. Where is the vantage point from where I can observe that the waking state is also a dream? You know, Swami points out very sweetly and nicely that you know that a dream is a dream after you wake up. In the dream, you don't know that it's a dream. It is as real. And if you have, you know, if you have taken birth and grown to be a 45-year-old, all those 45 years pass in your dream state. So also, Swami says that in this waking state, which is truly a dream, for you to experience that this is a dream, you will have to wake up out of this. You will have to wake up to your transcendental state, which is your true reality. Until then, it's not possible. It's just not possible, because in a dream, everything is as real. That is the explanation that Swami gives.
In fact, if you look at it, you know, there are these episodes from the lives of very many great masters who for the first time, you know, get into that very, very deep meditative state where they're, be it Swami Yogananda or Vivekananda, where they're like in a meditative state for many, many hours, and when they come back, for them it would appear like, you know, they've probably meditated for a few minutes, but then they realize it's like, you know, 5 hours or 7 hours or 8 hours have passed away. I think it's very similar to what Swami is telling here. You know, in a dream it looks like a lot of time has passed, but in the waking state, that dream time is actually much smaller. The same experience has when, you know, you feel it when you're in a transcendental state, or even for that matter, even when you're in a very, very deep sleep state. You know, sometimes when you wake up, it's like you feel like you've slept for a very long time, But then it actually is a very short time in deep sleep state.
Actually, I found the reverse happening, you know. You get up and you feel that only 1 hour must have passed. But you see that 4 hours have passed.
Right, right.
So you're so totally lost in the waking state, which Swami says is also a dream for the transcendental state.
Right.
So much time has passed, but actually it is so little, you know.
Right. In that sense, just that the reference of time goes away.
Goes away, absolutely.
Say, you know, in the waking state, I think earlier also Swami had said this in the conversations, the karma, kala, kartavya and karana. That is what defines the waking state. And when any of this gets actually messed up or, you know, becomes a little too strong, that is when the confusion comes. Swami would say that about Janaka. The reason why he wakes up from the dream and starts questioning the wakeful state is, he has a dream which is so real. Right? Swami would say that in a dream, you don't know where you've started, you know, what is the purpose. You suddenly dream that you're in Delhi, but you don't know why you went there. You don't have the experience of journeying from Bangalore to Delhi. So Swami would say that karma is not there. The time passing is not there.
Karana,
the purpose
reason
is not there. But they say that Janaka had a dream which was so real.
It had all the things.
It seemed like it had everything, you know, perfect. So that's why when he wakes up, he's not able to differentiate between dream and the wakeful state. So the main thing about, be it the dream state or the wakeful state, which is a dream state for the, you know, the self, all of this is because that karma, kala and kartavya becomes very real. And in the higher state, all of these, you know, look like there's no meaning to any of them.
And you know, in order to experience this, you have to wake up from this. And if you are not able to wake up, I think we have to take it on faith. See, the first part what Swami is saying, that when you wake up, you realize the dream was a dream, is something that all of us have experienced and it's fine. The second part of it where he's saying that this is also a dream, when you wake up to the transcendental state, you will realize it. I think that we have to accept it on faith, because the only other option is to actually wake up and experience it and then come back and know that, you know.
It's something very similar to somebody playing a prank on you. Right? If somebody is playing an elaborate prank on you, and let's say a friend has given you the tip that don't worry, it's just a prank. But the prank is still going on, and unless the whole thing ends, you're probably not out of the thing. But you're informed at least, you know, you know that you probably don't get very scared or you don't get too excited. I think that's what Swami says. It is a dream. Till you wake up, it's going to be real. But now you've been given the information that it's just a dream from a very reliable source. You've got to know it from Swami. So accordingly now you don't have to be too worried. You don't have to suffer every pain that comes and loss that comes.
Then, you know, actually the explanation continues. We just took a break because we wanted to share a few thoughts. Swami continues to say, the dream state is unreality in truth. The waking state is truth in unreality. And the transcendental state is truth in truth. The I in the dream state is taken to be the body. The I in the waking state is taken to be the mind. The I in the transcendental state is God. I think these are very profound statements. Swami is saying that the dream state, what we speak of, is unreality in truth. Because we are dreaming about it. The dream is unreal. Our existence is what we consider as reality. The waking state, Swami says, is truth in unreality. Because we are thinking that it is a reality. But actually, Swami is saying that is also based, that is also an illusion and that is also not real. Therefore, while one is unreality in the truth, the waking state is truth in unreality. If you want truth in truth, Swami says that is only the transcendental state. And why? Because in the dreaming state, who is dreaming? It's this body. It's this body-mind complex. And Swami says, therefore, the I in the dream state is the body. The I in the waking state is the mind. Because when I'm awake, when you are awake, if anybody asks, what am I actually? I mean, whatever I speak about myself is definitely associated with the mind, not the body. Because, you know, Prem, if somebody were to come and cut off one hand of mine, I will not say that, you know, I am 90% Arvind. I will not say I am 100% Arvind. Even if I lose my hands and legs, I'll still be 100% Arvind, because in my waking state, I'm I am identifying myself with the mind, not just the body. So Swami says, the I in the waking state is the mind. The I in the transcendental state, that is God, that is the Atma.
You know, there's this concept that Swami has spoken about extensively in other discourses also. The three kinds of truths or three kinds of realities, Swami would say, Paramarthika, Paramarthika, Pratibhashika and Vyavaharika. Right? So Paramarthika is the eternal truth, the absolute truth. As Swami would say, you know, Trikala Badhyam Satyam, it does not change. And as Swami is talking here, it is, you know, the truth in the truth. As Swami was saying here, right? The transcendental state is truth in truth.
Correct.
Right? It's always true. Then Swami says Vyavaharika is the current wakeful state.
Vyavaharika also means day-to-day interactions.
Right. It is real. Like suppose I give you some money or you owe me some money or something like that. That is truth and that is what it is. It is in your mind. It is in my mind. I might choose to deny it or somebody might choose to lie about it. But it's a truth. Right?
It's a fact, yes.
It's a fact. It has happened for reality. And Swami would say that suppose in your dream you're given money to somebody. The next morning you cannot go and ask that person for that money back. Because it's truth only in your mind. It's not truth for everyone. And Swami would say that is Pratibhashika. It is a reality which is created within your mind. And Swami would say that is what is the dream state. But what is true in the transcendental state is true for all times.
And I think that is the defining difference between what we say as a fact and the truth.
Right.
Like me giving, how can you say that me giving you money in the wakeful state is not the truth? Because it possibly doesn't hold good for all the three periods of time.
Right.
You know, maybe if we go back karmically, in the previous birth you have given me money, I have given you money. Like for instance, I would say, like when we say, Brazil or Germany or Italy is the World Cup champions. It's a fact. But it doesn't hold good for all the three periods of time. It changes. That's why I think there's English possibly doesn't have those words, but maybe we can say truth, fact, and virtual reality.
Right. And as Swami would say, it's not only about the dream state. It's sometimes even about emotions. So many times we imagine things about, you know, we think that that person is upset with me. We think that that person is cheating me or that person is a very cunning person. So I mean, all that is in your mind. It's not necessarily reality. Sometimes it might be real. But if you look at it, many of the things are truth for us.
And it affects us.
Right, and it affects us. Right, as Swami would say, that, you know, the classic example of seeing a snake in the darkness. It is unreal, but it still affects you. Your heart starts beating fast and you're trying to run away and all of that. So as Swami would say, a beautiful analogy that Swami would give is the relationship between these three is the relationship between the ocean, the wave and the froth, Swami would say. The froth is the most, fleeting in its existence, but it is dependent on the wave. And the wave is also not real because wave also raises and falls. All three are actually the same ocean in that sense. So Swami would say it's the same reality which comes into this wakeful state and the wakeful state projects into the dream state. So as you were saying, that this question comes from a very, very well educated in the spiritual thought, if you could put it that way. It comes from somebody who is very well informed in that sense. And that's why Swami's answer is also pretty cryptic and I'm sure he would have been able to relate to the answer better.
When you say that Hislop is not an ordinary soul, it's again evident from his next question. Possibly we'll just read the question and stop at that because that's all the time will be permitted. But I feel we should read the question because just now you made a point that Hislop is not an ordinary soul. You know, Hislop is saying, but Swami, there's another difference between dream state and waking state. In the dream state, one does not doubt his reality. Whereas in the waking state, there's an extremely strong doubt. In the waking state, one cannot believe that he is a real entity. One sees himself as a shadow and not as a real person engaged in activity. You know, when I read this, Prem, I said, go man, Hislop, you are thinking like that maybe. Because for me, as real as the dream state feels in the dream state, so real does the real state feel in the real state.
No, absolutely. I think, as you said, somebody was given really deep thought to it.
And he has experienced it. I mean, when he said... in the dream state, you do not doubt your reality. I said, yeah, correct. But in the waking state, it's extremely strong. I said, no, man, there is no doubt at all. So, the answer to this, I think, dear listeners, we'll discuss it during our Next week satsang, it's again very interesting and it's very inspiring as well. So on that note, we'll bring this afternoon satsang to a close. We'll end with a song, on the other side of which, as always, you'll be greeted by Brother Chandu with his segment, Love to Love.
करुणानिकेतन भक्त सखा प्रभु करुणानिकेतन भक्त सखा प्रभु भक्त सखा शरण मिलो भगवान शरण मिलो भगवान चरण मिलो भगवान दुख भंजन श्री राम दुख भंजन श्री राम केतन भक्त सखा प्रभु शरण मिलो भगवान दुख भंजन शीरा जन शीरा करुणानिकेतन भक्त सखा प्रभु